I want us to read all the way from Genesis 12:1 to the end of chapter 13. That's, see if we can get through that tonight. But we're going to read it before we talk about it any. There's a whole, in the Talmud, what we just covered in those two chapters is a tract about that thick. And it covers, and besides the Talmud, there's Midrash about it that's a thickness of a book. Because in the book of Genesis, it being the book of beginnings, then everything that can be known about the beginning of the promise is in these two chapters. It's the beginning of the call. It's when man had finished testing mankind. Mankind failed the test. So now he put the test onto a specific family, onto a specific seed or line that now would be the inheritors and the only one that God was really dealing with. And it's important to understand that this is the juncture at which mankind has lost its chance. You understand that? Up till now in Genesis, mankind had a chance. Now mankind has lost its chance with the selection of Abraham and a particular seed. People don't want to hear that.
Up until then, he hadn't selected a bloodline, or this.
No, up until then, it was open to any. All the people that came off the ark could have been part of the promise. Before the flood, all the people before the flood could have been. You understand? The justice of God was manifest in that the availability was to all. Now, here, this is 2000, approximately right about 2000 BC right now. That's essentially 4,000 years ago. Mankind, if we could see, if we could hear, we know that all hope for mankind is lost. Doesn't matter what man does from now on. It doesn't matter how good he is, how bad he is. Doesn't matter what he does. Mankind is no longer being dealt with after the promise of God. 4,000 years ago. Now that revelation has to come into you now. Your perceptions about that which is mysterious are ingrained. I mean, they're it's molten metal being formed with hot heat because they were formed by your fears when you were a little kid. They were formed by the fairy tales and the stories and the images. But all that doesn't matter. I mean, you got to come, something has to be hotter than all those fires that formed your opinions. Right now, you have to argue with me. I mean, if you don't understand, or if you talk to me, if you don't understand that right now, at this moment, we are as if we were 4,000 years ago, the human race has lost its chance. It's only if you're of a particular bloodline and a particular genetic line that you have any possibility. And none of you are of that bloodline except Matt, and that's doubtful. You understand? You don't have a chance. It talks about the Perizzites and the Canaanites and the Jebusites are dwelling in the land, but it's not theirs. You're dwelling in this land and it's not yours. I can't scream at you hard enough. I can't tell you There, what this means is that there is no you. You have you're as useless as a hunk of shit right now. Your plans are as useless as the stuff in the garbage dump, from God's standpoint. Which, if, since you're here, you must be interested in. Your ideas are as meaningless as a fly spot. Your thoughts, your opinions are as fruitless as the dirt. Up till this point, you had a chance to think about stuff and to have an opinion and to work it out in your mind and to really try to follow this, be a truth seeker and all that other. As of now, in this study, you are worthless unless Christ is resurrected. Unless the seed is resurrected. You have no future, you have no careers, you have no purpose, you have no reason. God doesn't love you. You're going to live for a few years, then you're going to die, and it's going to be as though you never existed, which is the worst possible thing that could be. Now, that's what the call of Abraham means to you. That's what the call of Abraham means to the human race. Are you hearing me? A little bit? That means it's impossible for you to get it right. It's impossible for you to even think about getting it right. It means that if you don't put on his righteousness, you are without hope. It means governments don't matter, nations don't matter, armies don't matter. Nothing in the universe matters save the resurrection. And the resurrection is only revealed in the total abandonment of yourself. In other words, you can't keep, in this moment, you can't keep anything. There is no opinion, no thought, no like, no dislike, nothing that you can keep, that you can retain after this moment. After this moment, the revelation of Christ and his resurrection within you can only be revealed by the law of God if you take no thought for yourself, if you abandon yourself completely. This is the most important juncture of your life. Nothing else compares to this. Take everything about you and flush it. And take every propensity that you have to consider the future, flush it. That's now what Christ is saying to you. Do you want to be my disciple? Then abandon yourself from this moment forward. Now, I've talked to you about this all these years that you've been around. But now it comes time for the nut cut, so to speak. Because in this process, no matter how much you've known, no matter what you've done, no matter what you've thought, no matter how long you've been here, you've still only been Genesis 1 through Genesis 11 up to this point. Now, hear me. There is no one that you can take with you.
To where?
To the other across this little barrier that we're, that's Great Gulf. That's wider than, there's nothing that you can take with you across it. You can pray that someone with you, like, if you have a child like Elise, you can be her covering until she reaches the age of the law or Sable. But there is no loved one, no relative, no hated one. There's no one that you can take with you across this gulf. There's There is no value system that you can take with you across this gulf. There's no cultural system that you can take. This is the meaning of the call of Abraham. Get thee out of thy country, from thy kindred, from thy father's house, unto a land or a place that you know not, but I will show you. Consider this carefully. Now, everything we will read in the Bible from this point on to Revelation only amplifies this simple tale that I've just said in the last few minutes. There's nothing you can take with you from now on. Now, a reasonable person then would have to ask, am I sure that I want to go on this trip? Am I sure that this next aspect, the next things that will happen to us as a people, am I sure that I want to do this? You're standing in front of this ride at this great unknown amusement park, and the price of the ticket is everything you own. And you can only see the door. You have no idea what's going to happen. All that the door promises you is that you will never be bored. One of the incredible things that we can see right at the beginning in Genesis 12, in verse 3, it says, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. In Abraham, all the families of the earth can be blessed. After the flesh, a whole lot of it's true because, you know, I mean, there's jillions of people that are either Muslims or Jews or Christians. But when it says all in the scriptures, it means all. And all of the families of the earth were blessed on the day of Pentecost, when the seed of Christ was shed on all flesh. All vessels, all families, all individuals of the earth at that point were blessed. So from God's standpoint, I mean, God didn't give a shit about it. It's 1,000 years or 2,000 years or 4,000 years. It's all the same instant. And that's what our minds have to see. That now for us, we are as each one of you must be tonight as Abraham. Okay? Now, he departed. That's the word yalak, which means he vanished from that spot. He was born 1996 B.C. As I said the other night, he was 60 when he left Ur. He was 75 when he left Haran. He was 80 when he rescued Lot and met Melchizedek. He was 86 when Ishmael was born, 99 when Sodom was destroyed, 100 when Isaac was born, 137 when Sarah died, 160 when Jacob was born, and 175 when he died. And Abram took Sarah his wife and Lot his brother's son and all their substance that they had gathered and the souls that they had gotten in Haran. Now what the hell does that mean? First of all, the substance there in verse 5, it's the Hebrew word rekush. It means, in English it would mean his estate. All his stuff. And he had a big estate by this time. He was extremely wealthy. But the Midrash says that in Haran he spent 15 years. He left Ur, remember? No, you can't. We're going to put the... I have to find the right map. This is starting to bug me. I'll do it later. I don't want to do it now. And it's not up there. It's in this box thing back here somewhere. No. The right man isn't up there. He began... The Midrash says that Abraham began to gather souls when he was 48 years old. Remember, he was 10 when he left Ur the first time, secreted away, sent to the island of Crete. He was taught by Noah and Shem for 38 years. He goes back to Ur. Now he begins. He begins to preach to that tower, the Tower of Babel. And when he preached to it, it fell. So he began to gather souls at the Tower of Babel.
So he's going through this five-fold thing?
He's exactly the five-fold thing. Go to Ephesians 4. Ephesians 4, verse 8. Well, verse 7. Unto every one of us is given grace according to the measure of the gift of Christ, wherefore he saith, when he ascended up on high, he led captivity captive, and he gave gifts unto men. Now that he ascended, what is it but that he also descended first into the lower parts of the earth? He that descended is the same also that ascended up far above all things, that he might fill, or rather fulfill, all things. And when it says fill there, it means that he met the law of all things. And that's a hard one to understand. But, and he gave some apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry. Now, that's not five different people for a body. It's a process that is inexorable, that the apostle is the dying seed that starts the body. As the seed dies and falls into the ground, then he begins to prophesy. He just says what's there. As he is saying what's there, he's in a sense preaching, and that makes him an evangelist. People begin to be gathered. As they begin to be gathered, then the aspect of pastoring and teaching is the natural outcome or natural flow of that. He's doing it to perfect the saints for the work of the ministry. This office can't do the work of the ministry. And that's the big one. I can't do the work of the ministry. You, when you leave and go in, and each, there may be three apostles here, I don't know. That's God's business. You understand me? Apostle? What?
The pastor can't do the work. What's the work then?
No. The work of the ministry. Listen. Some pastors and teachers for the perfecting of the saints for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ. Now what's the work of the ministry then? There's only one work of the ministry. To show others that they own all things. To show others, and therefore they can afford to give.
By just living.
By living. All right, back to Genesis.
No, so really, this is the first time that something I'm hung up here on something. I don't understand something. When you said that is not your office. I'm not arguing with you. I don't know. I don't understand what's being said at all to me.
What do you mean that's not your office?
When you said
I can't do the work of the ministry.
That's not my office.
Right.
Right.
That I don't understand what you said when you said that. That you might as well have said something to me in Indian. Because it apparently it has no meaning to me. I don't understand.
Well, because the definition of what Oli does is the definition of what it means to do the work of the ministry.
Maybe both. Maybe I don't have any idea about either one. No, actually, I think I understand your position pretty well, actually. So I guess it's the work of the ministry I know zero about. Or I have wrong ideas about.
That's okay. Let's just leave it like that.
Fine. Great Commission?
Sort of. But it's not, the Great Commission isn't too great. I mean, it just says, as you go into your world, make disciples.
If you've done... but you have done, in the beginning, you did do the work. I mean, you were.
Yeah, but I didn't do anything. I mean, if I ever did the work of the ministry, I would never have been a minister. Do you understand? I never did it to do anything. I never did it to get results.
Well, I know. Okay. But I'm looking at, you know, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors. I mean, it's like,
that
I,
all,
I see you in several of these.
They had to be all of them. Had to be all of them.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. To do the work
it's
of the.
A lot.
Yeah, but if I ever thought I was doing the work of the ministry, I would have stopped.
Right. But I'm talking about for the sake of this conversation.
Okay. What was that?
I don't know what you're all talking about. So
let me know what you're saying. The body is forming around Abraham.
So anyway, what happened? The reason this was asked is because Abraham began to do the work of the ministry when he was 48. He began to be an apostle when he was 48 years old. If we believe the stories in the Midrash, that's when he began to fall into the ground and die, and then began the process of losing. Up until, as of 48 years old, he was the heir, when he was 47, he was the heir apparent. He was the next god of the world. Nimrod was Nimrod's successor.
He had graduated, right?
He had graduated from all the wisdom of Seth and the wisdom of Shem and the wisdom of Noah and the wisdom of Enoch had been passed down to him. He had been raised, he had the right perfect bloodline, he had the perfect genetic line, he had the perfect training. He had been taught, well, this is what's interesting. It's not just that he had been taught stuff. He had been taught all of the basic sciences. In him was the resident wisdom of all the, Shem and Noah only had one student. Abraham.
They invested everything.
They invested everything in that one student. He, in Abraham, it was invested all of the basic, what we call the basic sciences. He is the one, according to not biblical, but to Nicholas of Damascus and Barsias and others, other historians, he was the one that brought the knowledge of astronomy and mathematics. He was the one that brought Pythagoras' theorem to Egypt from the circuitous route. That's what I'm saying, that we have a Greco-Roman view of history. From every other place in the world, they view Abraham as the father of all of these sciences and knowledge. And they just copied. In fact, in Greek history, it says that they got the information. Pythagoras, in some of his works, says that he got the information from Egypt. And Egypt says they got it from Abraham. So it's a big deal. I mean, we're talking, and then if we've talked about, there were two exoduses.
Yeah. I was going to say this is pretty consistent. You've got these guys who are, you know, the heir apparent. They're being groomed right into this thing, and then boom, they're gone. They do something else.
Right.
So at 48, that's the point you talked one night about the yoga guys or whatever it is. They get to a certain point and they take it to self. At 48,
it's the fifth chakra. If you want to get the
taking all this to himself.
Right.
You know, it just seems like most people don't even reach the apostles then.
Right. Nobody. Yeah. That's right. That's why, I mean, it is. This is the rarest thing in the universe. It always has been. You're going to hit that. That's going to hit you someday, right between the eyes. You have been given to know the mysteries of the kingdom of God. It's a huge responsibility.
Same point. All the mysteries delivered over, and then Abram speaks against the tower, and he speaks and acts against the idols, and he gets kicked out.
But as he speaks, they fall. That's why when John the Baptist spoke, when Elijah spoke, I mean, he had the authority of the universe behind his words. Because he spoke that which was basic. I mean, that's why when we begin to speak, watch out, world. You understand? We haven't begun to spoke. We as a body, see, here God was dealing with an individual. Now we have to be the one. We are one. When we begin the office, when we as a body begin the office of an apostle and begin then to prophesy or to speak to the world, to the idolatry, all hell's going to break loose. I mean, it's going to be weirder than you ever imagined. We'll get to that in a minute.
You know, I keep thinking about too when you said, you know, I'll bless you. Bless you, curse you, curse you. It seems so. I mean, I know that's true.
And you never, that means you never have to worry about vengeance. That's why you can forgive. You, if that weren't true, you couldn't forgive people. Do you understand? If you didn't know that God was going to get anybody that messed with you, you couldn't forgive people because you're too selfish. You hear me? Oh yeah, I'm real magnanimous. I can forgive everybody. And I have. Because it's like, you know, what's the chaff to the wheat? If any one of those people that did you wrong comes back in a state of need, then you give yourself to them. You can only talk to people that are in need. Otherwise, all you can do is bring forth fruit necessary for repentance. You can't talk about this stuff to anybody. You got to know that by now. You just show forth their ridiculousness. That's all you can do. You can show the ridiculousness of their idolatry. And that's all that's what Abraham started to do when he preached against the tower and against... I can just, I mean, there's great speeches I could
do. What a drunk tower.
And the most people aren't going to listen to you if they're not
mad. Yeah. All you do is make them mad. But once you've spoken, then their blood is off you. If you don't speak and they're in your world, then their blood is on you. Now, I don't know what that means. I don't want to know what that means. That's something I don't want to know. I do not want to know what it means for somebody's blood to be on me. That's something I just would rather not know about. It just freaks me out when I think about it. It's not a good thing. Yeah. We can't vote on it, no. Okay, so he had great substance, because as he was the body. You won't find, I mean, they'll talk, he's got this army. He's got a private army. He's got 368 people who are highly trained, who were born in his camp, who are trained men of war, we'll see in a minute. That means there had to be a mother and a father at least for each one of them. There were thousands of people. He is considered, Nicholas of Damascus writes all kinds of stuff about him. And it says when he came to Damascus, on his way, he was in, I wish I could show you, but in Haran is up in where Syria is now, and he came down, I mean, the northern Syria, and he came down to Damascus before he crossed over to Shechem, where he entered the promise. He stayed for a brief time in Damascus, and he made such an impact in Damascus that he still, I mean, that they wrote about him external to any historical documents. And what they found now in the library of Elba, which is in Syria also, it's a huge library. It's 17,000 cuneiform tablets. Something like 10% of the tablets mention Abraham.
Well, that's how he could afford to have the luxury to move among all these people. So it's amazing.
It's a mass of humanity. That as they move, they were their own culture. That's what I want you to see, just like we are beginning to be. All right. Even at this point, Abraham was very rich, as was Lot. Abraham had received his inheritance at the death of his father in Haran. He also was apparently going through the land preaching the concept of one God and attracted many converts in Haran. There were also many slaves, perhaps 7,000. In Genesis 14, he had an army of 318 trained slaves prepared for war. They were born in his own house. All these together made a great throng, perhaps several thousand dwelling with him. Nicholas said, quote, "He reigned as a king in Damascus and came with his own army. He had set out, not knowing where he was going, from Ur, with a group of people not knowing where he was going, or not knowing where they were going. He went forth not knowing that Canaan was the promised land. He left Haran and went into Canaan. And then he left Canaan and went to Egypt, because he didn't recognize the promised land when he put his foot on it. Now, does that sound familiar to any of you? There was a little drought in the land, so he left, rather than stay and endure. This can't be it. Doesn't look like what I think a promised land should look like. Now, so he left. Go to verse 6, man. It's important. Chapter 12, verse 6. He took Sarah, his wife, Sarai, and his Lot, his brother's son, and all their substance they had gathered, and the souls they had gotten in Haran, and they went forth to go into the land of Canaan. And into the land of Canaan they came. Now, this is, I can't tell you how important this next verse is, and it's one of the worst translated verses in the history of the known universe. The first thing that happened when he entered the promise, the place of Canaan, the land of Canaan, he passed through unto the place of Shechem, unto the plain of Moreh, and the Canaanite was in the land. And it was there that the Lord appeared. But he didn't know where he was. And so he didn't take advantage of this place called Shechem, or Shechem. It's really S-H in Hebrew, it's S-H-E-K-E-M, and it's the word for a neck, but it's the neck of an oxen. So it's the word for the place of the burden. In type, this is the place to leave the burden that you brought with you. Shechem. The place of Shechem. It's the first place you stop in the promise. It's the place where the Lord appears unto you, but you don't know it sometimes. But it's the place to leave the burden. And the word plain there is another bad translation. It's the word Elon, which means an oak. It's the strong oak tree. It's from the root El, meaning God, and then twisted like a rope for strength, and that was the oak. So it's the oak of Moreh at the place of Shechem. Abraham's first stop was at the place of burden, at the strong oak. Now, Moreh is the word for teacher, or the word for early rain. Abraham's first stop was at the place of dropping his burden, at a strong oak, at the place of the teacher, or early rain. Revelation. Rain, always in the scriptures, wherever rain is manifested, it's talking about revelation. And the early rain is the early teaching. The latter rain is the rain that but with the clarity of a perfectly cast bell, its perfect eloquence.
Why is this next sentence tucked right in between?
Yeah. And the Canaanite was then in the land. That's why he didn't know it was the promise. Just like in you, you're the Canaanite. The word Canaan, it has two meanings. One of them, it means humbled. It has the idea that it's a strong being on his knee, Kenan. But the other meaning is that it has the other meaning in the Hebrew, and it's strange, they don't know why it means both things. It means merchant. But what it really means then, if you could hear it, because the land of Canaan was the land of merchants, of trade. If you just think about it, if you're a merchant, it means you're really worthless. It means you can't do anything of value in and of yourself. You only trade in merchandise or souls of men. You're just a whoremonger. And when you recognize that, it causes you to become in a state of humility. Okay? That's what the land of Canaan is like. Now let's talk about Shechem a minute. It's now the town of Nablus on the West Bank. Now, if you... All kinds of shit's happening in Nablus right now. Infatada. It's on top of the ridge between the waters of the Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea. From this point, you could overlook all of the land. In the New Testament, it's called Sychar in John 4. It's the story of Jesus meeting the woman of Samaria. According to the present people that go there, there's nothing finer in all of Israel. It's the most beautiful point in all of Israel. Abraham camped there, pitching his tent under the yoke of Morah. Jacob buried under an oak the idols and earrings taken from his house. The oak is the place where all of your idolatry is put out of sight. Joshua's farewell address took place here after they first subdued Canaan. And that's the Haftorah reading for this part of the scriptures. We're going to read Joshua 24, which is really wild as our prophet reading. It was also the place of refuge. And it was here that they took this stone, the witness. Remember when we'll see it, where Joshua says, "I want to serve you must serve the Lord." And they said, "We will serve the Lord." And he said, "You can't serve the Lord." And they took this stone of witness against them. Well, that was buried under this tree. Jacob's well is here. That's where the woman of Samaria was caught by Jesus, or prophesied about the five husbands.
Oh, yeah.
But it really, what the Spirit says is that she was talking about your five husbands are your five senses. And that's what we're going to see in a minute is Abraham's battle with the five kings, where it's a type of your battle with your five senses.
Was she going with
the Gentiles? She was Samaritan. Samaritan is worse than Gentile.
Well, but I mean, I'm just
saying, yeah, it's the woman of Samaria, John 4.
Why would you even
Put
your bone at this?
Yeah, don't you know? I mean, you know, we've always heard that the place of God is in Jerusalem, and he says, "The time is coming and now is, where they that worship God must worship him everywhere and always in spirit and in truth." No longer in Jerusalem. That's one of the convenient scriptures evangelicals ignore. Jacob's well is near here. This is where we add the vision of Jacob's ladder. The 10 tribes made this their capital. So the 10 northern tribes, what they called Israel versus Judah. You know where the word Jew comes from, don't you? From Judah, the tribe of Judah. Yehuda, Jew. Israel is gone. It's dispersed. The 10 northern tribes are gone. They don't know where it is. The bones of Joseph were buried here. Nablus is now, yeah. When Judah and Benjamin returned from captivity to build the temple, the people of Samaria asked to help, but were refused. And this is Manasseh, a priest, was expelled from Jerusalem for an unlawful marriage, and he obtained permission from a Persian king to build a temple here in Mount Gerizim. And he made copies of the five scrolls of the Torah. The Jews consider these unclean. From this time onward, Jews said, "Into any city of Samaria thou shalt not enter." The people of Samaria were considered idolaters, even though they were instructed by Jewish priests. Today, the people who around Shechem are Samaritans. Their number is about 400. They still carry on the ancient documents. The only part of the Bible they accept is the Torah. They do not accept the prophets or the writings and the New Testament. And they still sacrifice the lamb on the mountain for Passover. Shechem became the capital of the 10 northern tribes of Israel rather than of Judah. The 10 tribes are lost because they intermarried and mixed completely with the world. Samaritan became a point of derision. That's why they call Jesus a Samaritan. When Jesus healed the lepers, there were 10 lepers that he healed. One of them was a Samaritan. The Samaritan was the only one to thank him. The parable of the Good Samaritan is really offensive to the Jews of the time. And Jesus first proclaims he is the Messiah at this spot to the woman in John 4. It's the first time he says from Abraham entering here now at Shechem with the place to the place of burden, jump forward 2,000 years, Christ first declares that he is the Messiah at this spot. Now jump forward 2,000 years. This is the spot, if you could see it, that you are standing right now as we enter the problem. I feel like we need to stop here. This is enough to think of.